From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a big advance in stem cell research. Scientists, for the first time, clone human cells from adult skin.
But first, the tense standoff in Ukraine between the interim government and pro-Russian separatists still occupying public buildings in more than 10 cities in the east, despite that disarmament deal reached in Geneva yesterday. Lawmakers in Kiev urged the separatists to lay down their arms, and they promised to carry out reforms, giving Ukraine's regions more say in government decisions, but the separatists have refused to back down. NPR's Ari Shapiro joins us from Donetsk. And Ari, what are pro-Russian separatists there saying today?
The separatists endorse this Geneva disarmament agreement in theory, but in practice, they say they are perfectly happy to lay down their arms as soon as the interim government in Kiev steps down. This is the government that replaced Viktor Yanukovych, who was ousted. We were just at the separatist headquarters in Donetsk a little earlier today, and there was a big sign saying Yanukovych is our president. Many of their signs are in English, clearly directed at an international audience. But all of that suggests that this disarmament agreement in Geneva may not be enough to end this standoff as people had hoped.
Well, how was it supposed to work? It's one thing to make a request from Geneva, but was someone supposed to implement it? I mean, was someone going to go speak to these parliamentary groups or try to get them to leave the buildings, or did they expect it just to be from their own self-motivation?
Well, this is the problem, is that world leaders agreed to this deal in Geneva, and the separatist leaders say none of those world leaders speak for us. There's sort of an agreement among the West that these groups are funded by and organized by Russia to a certain extent, but the separatists say, no, we are our own entity, the independent Republic of Donetsk, as they put it, and they have certain demands that they say were not met by the agreement in Geneva, namely that the interim government in Kiev leave, that they get an independence referendum on May 11th ahead of the presidential election on May 25th. Those deals, for the most part, are non-starters. As far as the demilitarization goes, the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, is supposed to help oversee the demilitarization. But first of all, diplomats say there are not enough OSCE representatives on the ground here to do that. And second of all, if the separatists don't want to give up their weapons, nobody is really in a position right now to force them to do so.
And you mentioned these elections. We want to underscore that the pro-Russian leaders in Donetsk are calling for this referendum on May 11th, a referendum on greater independence. But it's the leaders in Kiev that scheduled presidential elections for May 25th. So meanwhile, Ari, how does it feel on the ground there, the people that you run into? Is everyone consumed with this? Sometimes we see pictures on the TV or we hear from people like you, and it turns out that it's a minority of people that are involved in whatever the scrape is. Is this pervasive? Is everybody attuned to this?
Everybody's very aware of it, but I wouldn't say that it has stopped normal life. There was a moment early in the week, right after the military announced that it was beginning an anti-terror operation, where I think people were really bracing themselves for what looked like it could be civil war. But several days later, that so-called anti-terror operation has appeared to be not much more than a display of tanks and jets and helicopters. There has been the occasional confrontation in the town of Mariupol. There was an overnight incident that resulted in 13 injuries and 3 deaths. But there has not been the kind of large-scale effort to oust people from government buildings that you might expect. And so, after a few days, people seem to be going back more or less to life as normal. We were in the town of Kramatorsk, where there were a dozen Ukrainian tanks on the perimeter of town, and these jets flying low over the rooftops, and, you know, old women were carrying groceries, students were walking along in their backpacks, people were eating lunch outside on a beautiful spring day.
But meanwhile, there were those flyers distributed outside the main synagogue in Donetsk, asking Jews to identify themselves to authorities. That sounded very frightening, but what did you find on the ground?
I think people in the West see a flyer like that and they think, oh my God, there are echoes of the Holocaust here, which certainly was the intention of the people who made the flyers. But we went to the rabbi and the head of the Jewish Community Center, the people who were the first ones to lay eyes on this flyer. They said from the very beginning they knew that it was a provocation. and nothing more. They knew that this was a forgery. They don't know who did it, but it is an attempt to try to gin up fear and mobilize the international community. Yesterday, John Kerry spoke about this flyer, but here in Ukraine, nobody believed for a moment that Jews were actually being required to sign up, register, pay a registration fee, or risk deportation. The West has tried to characterize the separatists as Nazis and fascists. The separatists have tried to characterize the government in Kiev as Nazis and fascists. The rabbi we spoke to today said the Jewish community of Donetsk is being used as a pawn in people's political game, and they don't like it.
NPR's Ari Shapiro in Donetsk in Ukraine. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
President Obama is going to Asia next week. He's expected to talk up a proposed deal to increase U.S. trade with that region. And if he succeeds, it could open up huge new markets for U.S. farmers and manufacturers. It could strengthen U.S. influence in Asia and set a path to greater prosperity. At least, that's what the White House says. But his critics say the president has got it all wrong. They believe the trade deal, known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, would hurt U.S. jobs, degrade the environment, and even make the internet less open. One thing everyone does agree on, the TPP would be a big deal. Here to explain is Marilyn Giwax. She's a senior business news editor at NPR in Washington. Good to talk to you again, Marilyn.
Hi, nice to join you.
Great to have you. So first of all, tell us a little bit more about what the TPP is. What specifically does the president want?
Well, this is a trade deal that's a lot like NAFTA. That deal was put together 20 years ago, and it involved the United States, Canada, Mexico. And now you take those three countries and you'd expand this into a really gigantic free trade zone that would also include countries on the other side of the Pacific Ocean. So you're talking about Australia, Japan, big countries. So if you put it all together, you're talking about 12 countries that would unite their economies in a way that's never been done before. It'd be the ultimate goal is to create a tariff-free zone so that goods can go back and forth easily. And you know, the president says that this is a good way to grow jobs, that American businesses need to export into these dynamic economies in Asia, and that we need to be there. We have to be part of that game.
So it potentially could be a massive free trade zone. Give us some examples of what could change if the TPP is indeed completed and ratified.
Yeah, the big thing on our side of this is autos. That's getting a lot of attention, and that's because right now, the United States imposes a tariff. That's basically another word for a tax of 2.5% on Japanese cars that come into the United States. Well, you know, if you work for GM, you sort of like to see the U.S. government keep its thumb on the scale for your products. They like the idea of putting a tariff on Japanese cars. But under a trade deal, that would have to eventually go away. It needs to be phased out under the terms of this agreement. And on the other hand, a big deal in Japan is rice. That's very much a part of their identity. They care a lot about rice. So the tariffs over there are kind of just almost crazy. They're almost 800% on rice being imported there. So if you got rid of those kinds of tariffs, farmers in the United States, people who grow rice, they could sell more rice into Japan. That's a big market that would boost their profits. But for an automaker, maybe if you're making a Ford or a GM product, you'd face a little bit tougher competition because you'd no longer would have that slight advantage of having tariffs imposed on Japanese cars.
Interesting. So free trade advocates and economists love the idea of reducing trade barriers between nations. But you mentioned NAFTA and you mentioned jobs. And the thing that pops into my mind, Marilyn, takes us back to 1992 and Ross Perot, who said he was hearing a giant sucking sound going to jobs that would go to Mexico if NAFTA was indeed adopted. So is there similar opposition to the TPP now?
There's exactly the same kind of opposition. So, you know, usually a Democratic president would turn to Democrats to help advance whatever his agenda is. But this time, the president's got a tough time. The Democrats are not behind him in general on this. Very little support, at least being said out loud. There are a few, but mostly you're hearing U.S. Lawmakers want to defend American jobs, and they worry about this idea. Vietnam, for example, is one of the 12 countries that would be involved in the TPP. They point out that in Vietnam, the minimum wage is $2.75 a day. Huh. So if you're one of the few remaining textile workers in the United States and you're making, you know, $10 or $12 an hour, can you really compete with a textile factory in a country where people are making $2.75 a day? So, you know, there are a lot of concerns that some of these remaining factory jobs in the United States could really be harmed by this. And there are also things that people worry about. They're concerned about environmental standards being lowered, concerns about food safety, food that might come into our country that doesn't meet the same standards that we might expect, concerns about the internet, that if we were to do this trade deal, that we'd have to have more controls on the internet, that it wouldn't be as open as it is because some Asian countries have more censorship. There are a lot of complicated issues involving the cyber sphere. So there's lots of democratic opposition to this.
Interesting. And these are potent pieces of opposition, given the fact that the world is already so much more globalized than it was in 1992. But on the other hand, Marilyn, who's in favor of this new trade agreement?
Well, for the most part, businesses are strongly in favor of it. Certainly the Chamber of Commerce is. But there are also people who worry about national security, sort of the geopolitics of this. That is, China is a huge, you know, rising power. And it's been a little, some people would consider it sort of expansionist, that there are concerns about China. And many people feel we're not involved enough in Asia, and that if we were to put our strengths together with Japan and Australia and really pull together this Pacific Rim idea, it'd be a huge counterweight to China. And right now, China has a little bit of a bad reputation. You know, things like this Malaysian plane that went down. The Australians seemed like really stand-up guys that were trying to find the plane, and China seemed a little weak on that. So there are these kind of soft power issues where the United States, Australia, and Japan seem more attractive to some of the other countries in Asia. So there are supporters of this trade deal that say you need to pull that all together, make this a strong, attractive economy, and people will want to join with you, not with China.
Well, we'll keep our eyes on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and whether or not it actually goes anywhere. Marilyn Giewak, Senior Business News Editor at NPR in Washington, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's here and now. Happy Passover, happy Good Friday, and Easter is coming up. Jews gathered for seders this past Monday and Tuesday to remember the difficult flight from slavery in Egypt to freedom. Christian pilgrims are in the Holy Land today for Good Friday, the day of Christ's crucifixion at Calvary, with the promised resurrection on Easter Sunday. Both sets of stories and traditions are about values essential for us as human beings. And so is Eric Kobel's new book. Kobel is a psychotherapist and former minister of social justice at Riverside Church in New York City. His new book is When Your Life is on Fire, What Would You Save? And he joins us from the studios of NPR in New York. Eric, welcome.
Good to be here, Robin.
Really nice to have you here. And your title, a play on a very old question, what would you save if your house is on fire? You ask readers to think about that, but I love how French filmmaker Jean Cocteau answered the question in the beginning of your book. He was asked, if your home was on fire and you could only save one thing, what would it be? What was his answer?
His answer was, I'd save the fire.
That is very deep. So we want to get listeners thinking, probably many already have, about what they would save. You know, people have thought about a house fire. Of course, if minus people and pets, they are out safely in this theoretical question. People have thought about that. But what would it be for you, Eric? Start there.
Well, materially, I suspect what I would want to save would be my writings. And one of the things we did with this book, though, is we expanded the idea of the house fire to say that not only does the house contain everything you own, but think of everything you are. Mm-hmm. You know, your principles, your beliefs, your memories, anything you want to include that is of value to you. Imagine that in the house. And then on that basis, what would be the most important thing for you to save?
Well, because the first question gets trickier without the second. For instance, if someone says, I've got to save that car that I lovingly restored, you might say to them, well, how do you feel about money? Did you save any money? Because what are you going to restore it with?
Right. That's part of the conundrum is as people contemplated the question, they very often told me it wasn't a matter of thinking about what they would save, but all the things they were leaving behind. So it really was a sticky wicket for them.
It was what you're not just saving, but what you're forsaking.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that people told you? You spoke to a fireman, for instance.
Spoke to a firefighter who was actually the first female firefighter in the New York Fire Department. Her name is Brenda Berkman, and she is a recent convert to Christianity. And what she said, apropos of this week, is she would save the Beatitudes of Jesus, the blessings from the Sermon on the Mount. She said, without those, I would be a total moral wreck.
Well, but what is that? That's a thing. How does she go on to say what value that is that she's saving, or what value she would be saving?
Well, the reason it's so valuable to her is that she regards it as the blueprint of her life. One of the things she pointed out is in the conversations and in when your life is on fire, she said one of the most important beatitudes to her is blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. And she said, why I value that so much, and again, in her own words, is I'm not very much at peace with myself. So what she was really saying to me was that these are the ways that I have to try and mature as a human being. And they are in essence my blueprint for a stronger and more peaceful life.
Give us some other examples of not maybe what people said, but what you'd want people to think about if they're sitting here saying, "God, I spent a lot on that bicycle. I'd really like that bicycle. That's who I am." What are when you want to broaden it out to not just your house on fire, but your life on fire? What are some of the things you're asking people to think about?
I'm asking them to think about their beliefs, their dispositions. Their memories that are most important to them. There was a returning soldier from Afghanistan who suffered traumatic brain injury. And when I asked him, his name is Don Lang, when I asked him, when your life is on fire, what would you save? Don said, in essence, it's too late. I lost everything. The fire has already happened. And what he meant by that was he really lost everything about his identity because of his brain injury in Afghanistan. And what he said then was the most valuable thing to him was rebuilding who he is. So he focused on his personality. There was a woman by the name of Tao Porshan Lynch, who's 98 years old and is a yoga instructor, grew up in India. Her earliest memory, she was brought up by her uncle and aunt, her earliest memory was walking for independence with Gandhi. Mm. And she talked about her optimism, without which she couldn't be a teacher, she couldn't be a yogi, and as she said, she couldn't be a human being.
Boy, if everything was on fire, wanting to save your optimism is a challenge.
Yeah, it, to say the least, I'm not sure I would have chosen that, but she did.
Well, put this in the context of the season for us. One of the most powerful responses you got was from a rabbi. He related to the Passover story, again, the Jews fleeing the Pharaoh in slavery, and he related that to today.
Yeah, Arthur Waskow is this brilliant rabbi in Philadelphia. Arthur talked to me about his conversion experience, and what he said was he was living in D.C. back in when Martin Luther King was assassinated, which also happened to be the beginning of Passover in 1968. The federal government put a lockdown on Washington for a curfew, dusk to dawn, and Arthur and a group of other activists organized to bring food and medical supplies and other provisions into the African-American communities that were shut down because of the lockdown. He talked about walking down the street with these boxes of supplies, with military and with armed militia and tanks pointed at him. And he suddenly realized, he said, this is Pharaoh's army. The Seder, he said, is in the streets. Hmm. And that's when he decided to become a rabbi.
Hmm. And, of course, it's Easter as well, rebirth for mm-hmm. believers. But it's a very powerful time and can be for the secular as well. I have a friend who sees this time of year as a second chance.
It is. Yeah. Yep.
But
it
how
is.
Does it's, that oh, – well, go ahead.
No, you please. Go ahead.
I was going to say, how does that relate to your question?
Well, I think what it does is this. It's a season of rebirth in that in both the Passover story and in the Easter story, you have the triumph of hope and possibility over the forces of oppression and despair. And that is what I think your friend is touching upon. The way it relates to values is this. When we embrace the idea of hope and a season spurs that embrace in us, it can change the way we see life and thereby change what we really value most. or at least clarify what we really value most. And the important thing is not just the clarification of what we value. The important thing is to take the lessons of this season and figure out how to hold on to those values going forth into the rest of the year.
Yeah, and kind of what you don't like about yourself, let it burn.
Right. Incinerate it.
Eric Colbell, he's a psychotherapist, former minister of social justice at Riverside Church in New York. His new book is When Your Life is on Fire, What Would You Save? Eric, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Robin.
And to our listeners, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Go to hereandnow.org. When your house is on fire, what one thing, again, not people, pets, what one thing would you save and why? And then if your life were on fire, what one thing about yourself do you want to save, and what do you want to just leave behind? Let us know. hereandnow.org. You're listening to Here and Now.
This is Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. California officials are asking residents to cut water use by 20% to offset the statewide severe drought there. One conservation technique, recycling so-called gray water, the water that comes from showers, sinks, and washing machines. California passed one of the first laws to allow home gray water use. But as KPCC's Molly Peterson reports, there are some obstacles.
At my little house in Los Angeles, I can walk out my kitchen door a dozen steps to a stacked washer-dryer in a shed out back. My laundry water contains soap, maybe some bacteria, hair, and lint, but it's good enough to water outdoor plants. This is the most common type of gray water, and in most homes, mine included, it disappears down the drain. But over the last 15 years, a committed network of do-it-yourselfers has installed systems to capture used household water and funnel it outside for landscaping. Laura Allen co-founded Gray Water Action. She says the biggest obstacle to their cause is a lack of awareness.
And when your water comes from really far away, there's no need in people's mind to be aware, and there's no one's forcing you to be aware of what's going on with these water sources. It's harder. It takes more education.
Allen holds gray water workshops. On a recent Saturday, she showed 40 participants a gray water irrigation system at the Los Angeles Eco Village.
Right. The mulch filters it, and then it soaks into the soil.
Now, do you take the mulch all the way around or just around the
holes? No, just where you need.
Okay.
Yeah. There's one there. There's multiple ones. There's one there.
Okay.
A change in California law a few years back means that these people can install their own laundry water capture systems at home. The cost is low, a few hundred dollars of plumbing parts. Part of Alan's lesson is pulling pieces of plumbing out of a bag and helping people identify them.
Oh, that's the greenback ball valve.
That's Josh Ferrari. He came here with his parents, Mike and Margie.
I've always been a believer in reducing and reusing and reclaiming and regifting and every word. And so the idea that we can reuse water that's just right now going into our septic tank, you know, is very exciting.
The Ferraris want to recycle all their available gray water, but capture systems on showers and bathroom sinks require permits and inspections. Officials in her town told Margie nobody's ever applied before. Part of the problem is the complexity of the state rules governing the process. Architect Lee Gerard installs gray water systems. He says the state worked with traditional plumbers to write the gray water rules, and their thinking is old-fashioned.
You know, gray water violates the essential plumber's creed, which is that there's supply and there's waste, and never the twain shall meet.
One Angelino who went through the process is Mark Valianatos. He got permits and installed a system that captures all the gray water in his house. But there were a few speed bumps in the inspection process. Health departments worry do-it-yourselfers will potentially cross the streams, mixing drinking water with the dirty stuff. A health inspector made Valianatos' contractor redo part of his installation.
He had to paint on the side of this weird little plastic tank on my hillside, you know, not potable water, do not drink, which seems sort of ridiculous because no one's going to be coming, you know, snooping around. But it's that kind of thing that seems sort of weird.
Still, Valianato says the hassle was worth it. His house sits atop a steep hill, and he likes to watch his gray water flow down to fruit trees below.
It's something you can look at, you can touch, kind of connects you to your surroundings better than if everything's invisible in city pipes. So I like it for that reason, too.
Valianatos is the kind of guy who's doing everything he can to understand his water supply. He wants state and local agencies to help other people do that, too. For Here and Now, I'm Molly Peterson in Los Angeles.
And Molly's story comes to us by way of KQED's California Report. This is Here and Now. It's Here and Now. There's big news in the world of cloning, and to understand why, first, a little history lesson. You may recall, it was back in 1996 that Scottish scientists took the nuclear DNA from the cell of an adult sheep and put it into the egg of another sheep. That egg was then implanted into the womb of a third sheep, and Dolly was born, the world's first clone of a mammal. Ever since Dolly's birth, scientists have been trying to replicate this technique for humans, not with the hope of producing new human beings, but in an attempt to produce stem cells for medical use. Last year's researchers successfully cloned a human embryo capable of producing stem cells, but now another team has taken the technology a significant step further. They've created stem cells from adult human skin cells. NPR's science correspondent Richard Harris joins us to discuss this discovery. Richard, great to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, Meghna.
So first, walk us through this discovery. What exactly did the scientists accomplish?
Well, they repeated what I would consider the core of the Dolly experiment. That is, they took DNA from the skin cells of two adult men, and they put that DNA into human eggs. And after that is after the humans, the egg's DNA had been removed. Then they coaxed those cells to divide and divide, so it turns into a state that looks a lot like an embryo. Then those embryo-like cells, it turns out they can just keep dividing forever and ever. But the key is they can also be coaxed into becoming other types of cells. So you can take a little bit out of that and, say, grow a whole bunch of nerve cells, or you can take others out and grow kidney cells and so on. And so basically it becomes the starting point for a lot of exciting potential medical uses.
Okay, so it's very much like the technique that was used to make Dolly, but it sounds like it's even more versatile.
Yeah, it's quite similar in concept. Of course, let's not forget, though, that the huge difference is that in the experiment with Dolly, they didn't just with Dolly, they actually attempted to implant their embryo into the other sheep, right? And this was not the idea of this experiment. So they stopped at the embryo stage. They didn't keep going on to try to clone a whole person. And obviously many details of this experiment are different because, you know, scientists have been trying to do this for many, many years, ever since Dolly, really. And it's taken a long time to tweak the recipe just enough to figure out the right conditions to make this happen.
Right. And it seems like one of the most exciting parts is that they used the original cellular material they used was from adult skin cells. Now, why is that important that the sample came from adults?
Well, that is an important advance because some scientists argue that basically the adult cells can be used, they're more usefully in medicine than the infant cells. And I might add that actually before this experiment was done, there's been a long history of trials and errors. And the success with the infant cells last year is sort of the crowning achievement of, you know, all of these years of trying to make this work. The most infamous case of this was a guy named Woo-Suk Wong in Korea who claimed he did this about a decade ago, but actually nobody could reproduce his results, and he ultimately was accused of actually fabricating them. So that led to a whole decade of frustration before the advance last fall with the infant cells and now the adult cells. So we've pretty much now come full circle and done the Dolly experiment, at least up to making the embryo.
Okay, so regarding this new technique and this new breakthrough that we're discussing, how will these particular stem cells be useful in treating diseases, for example?
Well, that remains to be seen. And for one thing, it turns out that there's another way to produce these stem cells without using the egg injection method. And researchers have actually been using those other stem cells to do things like grow nerve cells. And they've been implanting them in the eyes of people who have vision problems and so on. So there are a lot of possibilities of what you could do with these cells. But in the first place, no one's sure that the Dolly method is going to be better than the existing method that's already being tried out a little bit in human beings. But I mean, think about replacing broken heart tissue or these vision problems or so on. And so there's a lot of possibilities here.
Mm. And Richard, just to be clear, because I want to be sure I've got this straight, the scientists were able to coax the stem cells to form different sorts of tissues, at least in the early stages, right?
That's right. And I don't think they've done the entire symphony of possibilities, but people have been here before and they're pretty confident that once you get to this stage, they pretty much know the recipes for coaxing it into other sorts of cells.
Okay, so that's exciting. But on the other hand, I heard you say a little earlier that the intention of this experiment was not to create an actual viable you know, human embryo. But that's, of course, I mean, we were talking about Dolly earlier. Dolly was an embryo that went on to become a sheep.
That's right,
viable living organism. Is that even possible with this new technique?
Well, we don't know. We are, in principle, closer to cloning a human being with this technique. And theoretically, if one of these synthetic embryos is implanted into a womb, there's at least some chance it could develop into an individual who is genetically nearly identical to one of the men who donated their DNA. However, that said, there's a huge risk that if anyone actually tried this, the resulting person would actually have any number of very serious health issues. That chances of getting a really healthy person out of a process like this seem to be very small. And so that's just one reason why even attempting that is considered an unethical step.
Okay. Well, so that actually preempts the next question I was going to ask you. But I'm going to ask it anyway, because we can't have a conversation about embryonic stem cell research or just even synthetic embryonic stem cell research without talking about all the attendant controversy that goes along with it. Does the technique obviate the controversy, or are people still concerned about the fact that if indeed it could go on to become a viable embryo, that we have the same problems all over again?
Well, we certainly do have the same problems all over again, and there are many layers of ethical issues. Let's step back a second and remember that some people considered the manufactured embryo in this research to be a potential human life, and even if in these experiments it remains a ball of cells, people still find that in itself objectionable. Some people do as unethical. Not everyone, of course, but that's issue one. The other issue is the potential cloning of a human being. Not only is it an ethical question because you might not produce a healthy person, but it's just the whole idea is repugnant that you could produce somebody by essentially a genetic duplicate of yourself, as opposed to doing reproduction the traditional way. And of course, let's remember that it's not just a person's genes, but also your environment that shapes who you'll be. So you're never even going to be able to make a complete true clone of yourself in any event. But these whole ideas are understandably make people queasy and very uncomfortable, and many people consider them unethical. That said, it is interesting that there is no federal law against doing this. And while some states have banned it and professional scientific communities and society say, no, this is unethical, don't do it, it could still be done by a private lab somewhere. It could be attempted at least.
Well, Richard, we've got about 20 seconds to go here. But what window does this give us on possible next steps in stem cell research?
Well, there are many different directions. And I think part of the intrigue here is nobody really knows what's going to be the big payoff. And there are many avenues to pursue. And people are doing taking all sorts of tries. So you'll have to ask me back in a while. And we can maybe answer that question more fully.
And we certainly will. Richard Harris, NPR science correspondent. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's Here and Now. While the Boston Marathon will be the center of international attention this year, the marathon has always been a focal point at a Boston clinic that treats children with cancer. For each of the past 16 marathons, many patients at the Childhood Cancer Program at Massachusetts General Hospital have been paired with runners, using the race as a symbol of endurance and strength to inspire youngsters undergoing cancer treatment. Two former patients ran last year but were stopped before the finish line because of the bombings. But they'll be back running this year, determined not to let what happened last year tarnish a race that, for them, signifies hope. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, WBUR's Deborah Becker has the story.
The Boston Marathon has been so much a part of the treatment at Massachusetts General Hospital's Childhood Cancer Program that it now has what's known as the Marathon Mural Hallway.
We have little footsteps and a start line for the Boston Marathon and a finish line. And when we do...
Dr. Howard Weinstein is chief of the program. He's been planning this hallway for years, and it was completed in October. The walls are lined with all sorts of images, photos of patients and the runners they're paired with, mementos from the pasta dinner for runners and their patient partners, and images from Mile 20, where supporters and patients gather to cheer on his running team.
What is that photo? Is that you?
That's me.
That's you holding
So that's holding
little...
my patient.
It's a dramatic photo of Weinstein stopped at mile 20. The name Lily is written in black on his arm. He's smiling widely as he holds Lily, the toddler, tightly hugging his neck, her missing hair evidence of chemotherapy.
That was my patient partner 2 years ago, Lily, who was just about a year into her therapy for leukemia. She's now completed all of her therapy. We'll be at mile 20 again, and she's been a great inspiration. And you can imagine a hug like that from your patient can get you from mile 20 to Copley.
Inspiration is what Weinstein hopes the marathon gives his patients. It's a symbol of tenacity, courage, dedication, and the strength of the human body. All things a child needs to remember during treatment. And he wants this hallway to be a year-round reminder.
And it was really to also bring to life on a daily basis how important the marathon program is to our childhood cancer program. Also, I think, be an inspiration to our patients who will be participating in future years.
The first time one of Weinstein's former patients joined in was 3 years ago. Six former patients will be running this year.
This huge photo at the start is Lindsay Bagan, and this was Lindsay last year.
Last year was the first time 26-year-old Lindsay Bagan tried to run the Boston Marathon. Bagan, who is from Medfield but now lives in California, was diagnosed with bone cancer at age 10. It's been in remission for years.
Running the marathon was just an incredible experience. And, getting to mile 20 was one of the most amazing things that has ever happened. Just seeing my entire family there, knowing that they all supported me.
A few miles after mile 20 last year, Bagan and others on the Mass General team had to stop because of the bombings. They wandered around for about an hour before they got to a prearranged meeting place and found out exactly what happened. Luckily, no one involved with their team was hurt. Despite last year's tragedy, Bagan is looking forward to another chance.
I am excited that I get to run again and share that experience with even more people this year because everybody is so passionate about the marathon. And I'm just excited to run across the finish line and have that feeling of accomplishment.
Bagan anticipates having a wide range of emotions when she crosses the finish line on Monday. And so does Weinstein.
It's unbelievable for me to be able to run side by side with some of my patients. There's no way to describe that feeling. You know, for me, it's one of the most important days of the year.
And both of them say nothing that happened last year is going to change that. For Here and Now, I'm Deborah Becker.
It is going to be quite a powerful day this coming Monday. 36,000 people running the Boston Marathon. Patriots Day, by the way, here in Massachusetts, a holiday. It'll be the 118th running, the first, as we've been hearing, since the bombings. And many of the runners are hoping to erase that memory. Here Now's Alex Ashlock has been speaking with top runners in this year's field. He's in the studio for a preview. Hi, Alex.
Hello, Robin.
So Kenyans won last Sunday's marathon,
right,
in London. I'm just guessing that maybe African runners are the favorites here on Monday.
Pretty good guesser you are,
yes.
Robin. Since 1990, African runners have won all but two of the men's races in Boston. It's pretty much the same for the women. Women from either Kenya or Ethiopia have been the winners in all but 2 years since 2000. We had an Ethiopian man win the race last year, Lalissa Dasiza. He's back to run again. Kenyan Dennis Kometo, however, might give him a run for his money in mm-hmm. Monday's race. Kometo is running Boston for the first time, but he won the Chicago Marathon last year in course record time. And last year, DeSissa, by the way, was also running Boston for the first time, and he won. So that might be going against the argument that you really need to have experience on this course because it's so unusual.
Right. Well, and no Americans have won either the men's or women's marathons here in Boston since the mid-'80s. There's speculation, maybe wishful thinking, that could change this year, but start with the men.
The American men who are here are really talented and experienced, but again, none of them have ever won the Boston Marathon. Ryan Hall's been here before. He has three top five finishes. He told me this morning he's fit and ready to go after a month of training in Ethiopia, which he described as like being in a running monastery.
Very tranquil, very peaceful, and the hardest training I've ever done in my life. It's makes you tough as nails.
The other guy I'd keep my eyes on Monday is from Arizona. His name is Abdi Abdurrahman. He's been on several Olympic teams. He was on the Olympic marathon team in 2012. He's never been to Boston before, and he tells me that all of his friends say, hey, you're a professional marathoner, and you've never been to Boston?
Hey, what's up with that?
Yeah, you've never run Boston. So he had a big smile on his face, and he's ready to go on Monday. Yeah.
Well, and if you saw 60 Minutes recently, you know a lot of people are thinking an American woman might win this year. Tell us your thoughts.
Yeah, that's interesting. Kenya's Rita Jeptu won the race last year, the women's race. She's back to try to do it again. But Shalane Flanagan, who I think was on that 60 Minutes interview, finished fourth in the race last year. She is a Massachusetts native. She used to come to watch her dad run the marathon. People say she's laser-focused on winning this race. And so much so that she didn't even come to the press conference this morning for the top runners because she's still training.
Yeah.
And that's pretty unusual. They're almost always here for this press conference. So that was sort of a surprise this morning. There's also Desiree Linden. She ran a really great race here in Boston 3 years ago. She finished second.
I mean, I think that was all about competing at a really high level. And, you know, when you do it, you know you can do it. And I've done work that shows that I can be there again. So that is still a nice confidence boost.
Well, so those are the elite runners. And then there's us.
the back of the Packers.
The back of the Packers. You know, vast majority of people running in Monday's marathon, they know they're not going to win. But so many of them are running for someone else this year.
That's really true this year. I met a man yesterday, Dave Fortier, who was just finishing the marathon last year on Boylston Street when the first bomb went off. He lost part of his hearing, but he's one of more than two dozen survivors of the bombing who will be running on Monday. Then there's also Team MR8, which is running in memory of Martin Richard. He's the little 8-year-old boy who was killed in the bombings last April. Rachel Moo is on that team, and she taught Martin in her second grade class.
She says it was an honor and a privilege to be part of the team and foundation that has been started for him. I mean, this is a little boy who held up the sign in that class saying, no more hurting people. So
Peace. He
will be very much on people's minds. And Meghna and I will be at the finish line to cheer everyone on. Alex Ashlock, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
You'll be there as well.
I will.
As always. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.